Welcome to Esoteric Modulation, episode 022, Patch CV.
Esoteric Modulation is your podcast that covers all the wild and wonderful world of modular, exciting and unusual instruments, guest interviews, sound snippets, and we also take a look into the interesting sound and visual art projects too. I'm Ben Wilson.
And I'm Ed Ball. Wow, Ben, where's the month gone? We're back.
I don't know. They fly by. There's so many conversations lately that start exactly that way, but where's time gone?
Craziness, isn't it? So in that time, what have you been up to, Ben?
Streaming, videos, yeah. Demos of all sorts of things. It's been really nice to see Random Step in more systems that was released a short while ago.
Yeah.
My sample and hold based module with a steady state fit.
Yep.
Yeah, really lovely to see people do that. I was talking to Heinbach about this with his app Fundamental and how nice it is to see people create with something you've created.
Yeah.
I've also been playing around with the Loose Fruit from God's Box, and it's a sound that I had from the video and pulled out a longer piece from going back and looking at the video demo for that, which we can link in the description, and running granular piano loops through it. And it's a kind of distorting, saturating wave shaper, interesting modular device that you wouldn't really think of for maybe processing a piano. It'd be a bit heavy-handed. But what strangely seemed to happen under modulation is it's created this almost vinyl crackle like sound. It's just crusty and nasty, but the piano's quite distinctive still. It's not like a piano through a distortion pedal. It's like this layer of crust.
Yes.
And I just wanted to play a bit of that because it's a really lovely sound.
The gnarly crust, shall we call it? Right, let's have a listen to the gnarly crust. Yeah, well, that's called noise memory, and I think that's really apt for it, isn't it? Because it's sort of like the fabric's been torn apart in it. I think that's quite an apt name for it. I do feel gnarly crust is also a good one as well.
I think gnarly crust is the better name. But yeah, it's something Heinbach spoke about before, of going through tape and using old tape, and this idea that these kind of little ghostly noise memories that maybe haven't been fully erased from the tapes. It's interesting in that there's some subs created, some subharmonics and kind of sub oscillations created. And you can hear this lower piano note that just seems to be kind of pulling a little bit slower than the main melody. And that separation, I think, works well. It's like this smearing, let's say it's tearing or smearing of time. The noise sometimes takes over. It certainly doesn't sound like it was an intentionally recorded piece. It's got that essence of noise memory in the back of the tape that you're trying to record over. But what have you been up to? What have you been playing around with?
Well, I've been working on my next art project, which we'll talk about maybe in the next episode. Although it's not an esoteric instrument as such, I'm thinking of downloading the 3 MPC beats and just having to play around with it. I've been interested in the MPC workflow for a long while, but I've just not delved into it because I thought, oh, hang on a sec, is it going to be another Digitact? Am I going to get it and, you know, spend that money out, and then I'm going to have to sell it again because I'm not too sure about the workflow? But of course, the free software just gives me the ability to dive in and mess around and see if I do like that. And I think that, if we take Scott Campbell when he was on the show, he used the Roland MC-707 and it was totally his sound. It was totally esoteric sound, but of course it was done on a 707 that you would think would be more of a groove box. And so I'm thinking, you know what, if I did quite get into that MPC workflow, for a decent amount of money, the MPC one with the CVs out, you've got a sequencer in there, you've got a sampler in there, and it's good money for what it is. So I thought I'd have a play around with that piece of free stuff, and it's free. Amazing.
Yeah, and it's a look into modern Akai, isn't it? It's where are Akai at with their kind of workflow? Does that gel with you? I think it's a really nice way to just try it. Because if it does gel with you, there's quite a few people I know interested in the new MPCs and the MPC one. As you say, CV in and out could integrate really nicely.
Yeah.
might be this alternative to maybe an Electron style workflow and capturing in a Digitact or an Octatrack that just might kind of artistically gel with you more so than, well, as you say, the Digitact did.
Yeah, and linking it to the other show the other day as well with Reb Strike Down, of course, he really is an advocate of the Digitact for the heavy lifting of, you know, sequencing and sampling. Of course, I didn't get on with the Digitact, but yeah, I'm interested. I mean, you know what? I love esoteric instruments, so yeah, I don't know. It's going to be the answer, you know, but at least it gives me a flavour.
And you can see for free. There's absolutely no harm done. Unlike some of the esoteric stuff, it's not shelling out a lot of money for quite an unknown, an uncertainty in your life as to when you get it and how it may interact with you. And
yeah, definitely.
I might check it out.
Yeah, I'm going to grab it. So we'll have a chat about that in the next show. And also, I've been playing around with the sound snippet from last show. I did say that I might start messing around, putting it into the Micro Granny and maybe cassette and things like that. So I thought I'd keep up with that theme and over the next couple of months sort of flesh that out as a little sort of project on here. And so, yeah, I took a little snippet of Bacteria and I ran that through the Micro Granny quite a few ways, actually. I did it on a 16-bit track first, directly onto the card. So I sort of took it down to 16-bit 220 50 hertz mono and then put that on the card. Then I did an 8-bit version, put that on the card and played that back through. That was quite nice. Then I did an 8-bit directly into the microphone, and that's where we start getting the tearings of time, just like yours. We've got a bit of a gnarly crust 2 coming, I believe, in my sound snippet. Shall we have a quick listen to the next crusty, gnarly, granular, ripped apart sound snippet?
Yeah, play it in all its crusty glory.
Brilliant. Here it comes.
So not only is it 8 bits and 22,050 kilohertz sample rate, you've got the lo-fi-ness of the microphone and all the analog to digital technology in the Micro Granny. And that just seems super crusty. I really like this term crusty that we're using. It's horrible. Let's be honest. If you went, oh, I've managed to record something, it's like, you've not done that right well.
Oh, no. These poor people, we've just bombarded their ears, haven't we, with two terrible recordings, and they must think, what's going on? But I think the thing is with that, of course, I've not got that going into any effects, and I think those crusty sharp bits that are on there will just sort of catch through the eventide space beautifully.
Oh yeah, massively so. And that's all the things you did in the piece, and we should say Bacteria was the name of the piece you played last month in the last episode.
Yes.
When you were saying, I'm going to take the original Bacteria. I had you in a kind of Petri dish. working away at some kind of bacteria in a lab. It was all the kind of sonics and effects of that captured, and then the dry capture in the Micro Granny.
Yeah, that was totally dry capture in the Micro Granny, so I think if I add then effects onto that, bring it back into the project, I think I might be onto something. But we'll see for the next show.
Yeah.
I suppose we better get into our guest, hadn't we? Because we've got a lot to ask this week.
We have, and something I've been enjoying so much so I've already watched it a couple of times, even though it's only just come out. Let's get into it.
This month's guest is a Grammy-nominated gold and multi-platinum award-winning songwriter and producer. He's had 5 international top Billboard charted hits, including number ones, and has achieved an audience of over 1.4 billion for his creative works on radio and streaming online. He's toured the world and performed as a drummer with Bruce Springsteen, Don Henley, Exposé, Sheryl Crow, Engelbert Humperdinck, Glenn Frey, Love Boy, and many, many more. He has produced Latin jazz albums on the Verve Jazz label, one of my favourite labels, that has featured Herbie Hancock, all starting at the ripe old age of 18. He's been a First Call A-list studio drummer, vocalist, synth programmer, and electronic product consultant since the mid-1980s. He's orchestrated Steven Spielberg's directed theme park rides and has been the voice of Clifford, the Big Red Dog plush toys and cartoons. His father started a studio recording program in the early 1970s as a degree in Miami and designed the first electronic drum set with Bob Moog and Bill Ludwig Jr. Our guest currently is working on his first solo album since the 90s and is launching a music library specific for the needs of the educational system. On top of all this, he was the creator and director of Patch CV, a film that I have been waiting with bated breath for. This is the reason we're talking to the man behind all this prolific work today. His name is David Elliott Johnson. David, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here, Ed. Thank you so much.
Wow, David. Well, I really don't know where to start here because you've done so much, and I know all three of us are really eager to talk about Patch CV. And to ask you for a quick rundown of your career would really not be a fitting question, I think, at this stage, as you've been so prolific and you've done so much from an early age, coupled with an amazing journey that I think really starts with your father, and there would be just so much to get through to do it justice. Usually at the end of a show, when we've not run through all our questions with a guest, we ask them, will they come back on the show again? So you're going to be the first guest that I've asked this before the actual show starts. So David, will you come on as a guest for us in the future? Because you have got a lot to talk about.
Oh man, it would really be a pleasure. I just love sharing. I'm at a point in my life where I want to educate people and introduce them to new things and enlighten and inspire new creators and artists. That's where I find myself at this point in my life.
Well, I think on that note, what I'd like to say to people at this point is, until we have you on again, I would ask them to head over to a great podcast called The Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you're interviewed there about your life and career. It's got some great insights into you and your family. It's amazing. Amazingly touching in parts. It also gives a great idea of what you've packed into your life. That was a great show. Did you enjoy doing that, David?
Oh, I absolutely did. That was basically inspired by the author, Sereni Rao.
Yeah.
His book is called An Audience of One. And I was just starting to read that book when I was working on Patch. And so this will all kind of flow as we get into the conversation and the interview here. But I was so inspired by his book that I reached out to him, you know, I think it was the second day the book was released. And I just wrote this letter of gratitude, how his book inspired me and opened up my mind and made me feel very connected to myself as a creator, and realizing that I was stuck in this, in the same loop as a lot of creators find themselves, especially with social media and those concerns. But he reached out and said, man, thank you so much for this interview, you know, for reviewing my book. Would you like to be on my show? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I'll do your show. And then I saw the 500 people and the geniuses and incredible minds that he had interviewed prior to me. I was like, are you sure that you want me on there? And you've got some pretty heavy, powerful people here with, you know, life-changing knowledge. Yeah, I don't see myself on that level. And he was like, no, I think this will be good, you know, and it was a great conversation. And he's such a genuine individual and he's very caring.
Yeah.
He's great. And I can't say enough about that book, An Audience of One. It really is life changing.
Well, it's really weird because obviously I did that for my research, listened to that podcast, and then I hit his website and I was like, oh my God, where's this website been all my life? I mean, some of the stuff that he goes through and the criteria and that. And I was thinking, wow, I've got to read that book. So actually, I'm on holiday in a couple of days' time, and I'm going to grab that book and go through it. And I want to dig down more into his ethos and into his website, because it's just right. It's like, you know, creators, we usually are running around with lots of different projects, not too sure what to do, not ending projects, starting other projects. And he seems to have a really good grip on that side of things. So it's one thing that, you know, your podcast being there has turned me on to his work.
Yeah, while you're touching on that, on his website, he gives a lot of free stuff away. And he's got this one PDF that's about the creative process and reconnecting with your creative source.
Yeah.
And he basically takes all the knowledge and inspiration from all the different interviews that he's done and places it in one place for you to digest.
Nice.
And it's free and it's absolutely wonderful. I can't recommend them enough.
So with that in mind, my first question to you is that can you pick a few of the strands out in your past, because there's so many, that would have contributed to you having the idea of Patch CV, and what the reasons behind the inspiration for creating Patch CV were?
Yes. That would be the first answer. Yes, I can.
I thought, oh, this is going to be a tough one to start with. What strands do you pick?
I like to give that dramatic pause. Yes. And what's to follow? At some point in your life, based on your success, you become that guy. You become recognizable for doing something that people identify you as that guy. You're doing your thing. But what they really don't know is that thing they want is something that was essentially a hiccup in your soul. And you're doing it without thinking. You were doing it without direction, without successful intention. You just let go. You followed the muse. You adapted to the moment. And then you delivered your idea. And you didn't, quantify it. You didn't give it any value. You were like, hey, this is what I've done, and this is what's come out of it. So here you go. At least it was an opportunity for me to be honest. And then at some point in that success, you become externally directed towards wealth and greater successes. And eventually you get wrapped up in this loop and you wind up losing that authentic impulse, and you start to resort to muscle memory and emotional reference to those moments of inspiration. And you wind up creating your own personal map to those moments so you can reach them quicker to be productive.
Yeah.
But at some point you realize that your internal truth no longer exists. The honesty isn't intact. It sounds great. It came from you. It's your thing, but it lacks that intangible connectivity that connects you to your audience. So it becomes just another offering to the community. It fits the need. It fits the moment. It gives you another paycheck and gets you onto the next thing. And that's what I lost and needed to rediscover. The why I do what I do and why I love to do it. And that's how Patch came about, because I saw in others' musical expressions what I had lost. So I was kind of feeling drained of creativity, and I was just working. I was just meeting the needs of daily creation, of writing for film and television, or writing pop songs, or country songs, for that matter, at that time. And I just stopped. I just went, this isn't doing it for me anymore. Am I sure that I even want to continue doing this that I've done for 35 years? Is this something that I want to continue doing? And I happened to buy an Analog Solutions fuse box.
Great thing that is, isn't it?
Right?
We know, and the orange, yeah, beast.
So I was just like, maybe I need to get back. And I have a synth collection myself, but I was just kind of in this moment of being bored with those synths. And so I bought this fuse box, and I was just on Instagram. And at this point, I really wasn't on Instagram at all, but I was following these YouTube things and, all these demos of the fuse box. And I just stumbled upon Corey Sterling, Red Stripe Down, who you've had on your show.
Yeah.
And it said, he said, follow me over at Instagram. And I was like, oh, this Instagram thing, I really don't want to be a part of it, but let me check it out. I went down the rabbit hole. I watched everything that he had ever posted and was mesmerized. And I was like, this guy is so connected and present in his ability to create. I want to do that. I need to get back there. And I mean, even still thinking about it right here, sitting in his chair at this point in time, in this moment, I feel the same emotional charge as I did when I think about it and talk about it, because those short little 60-second clips inspired me on such a level that I was like, okay, I need to know this guy. I need to reach out to him. I see that he's in Chicago. I'm going to Chicago in 2 weeks on vacation. I'm going to find this guy. And at the same time, I had said to my wife, hey, there's this shop there called Nerd Audio. And me being a geek, I want to go there, and I've never been there, and I want to check it out. I had no idea at that time that Corey ran that shop at that time.
Oh, wow.
So after I started watching Corey videos, I stumbled upon Nero Bellum. And Nero Bellum, just what he can do from just an oscillator kick drum into a full-blown cacophony of visceral rawness is mind-blowing.
I love his stuff.
And I've seen this guy start from one cable. And it just felt so honest and so genuine. And then I went down the rabbit hole. I found Todd Barton. I found Brian Knoll. I found Patrick O'Brien before the POB. I found Shiro Fujioka. All of a sudden, I started finding these people. So I flew to Chicago and I met with Corey and I said, what is this thing that you use to make this brilliant music? And he goes, oh, it's modular, man. It's Eurorack. Now, I was brought up on modular systems, but it was all in the 5U Moog system. And I'd had plugins where I was patching and doing different things. But when he just started patching some things in the store, I went, okay, I have no idea what you're doing. Completely baffled by this. And I said, man, have you seen this guy Nero? He goes, he was in the store yesterday. It was like, how was he in the store yesterday? He goes, he just moved here from LA. And I went, can you call him up? Can he come? I was like, mom, can he come over? Can Nero come over? You know? And so he got on the phone with Nero, and Nero showed up the next day, all dressed in black. And he was the nicest, soft-spoken individual. And we just talked about music. We talked about the inspiration behind what they do and why they've chosen to pursue this. I don't know how much Corey told you about him, but he's a degreed bass player from Berkeley. I mean, the guy has serious musical chops.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the way he has adapted that into the modular technology is just fascinating to me, the way he thinks and the way that he composes. So I went back home and I started thinking, I want to do something different this year. I'm tired of making records. I think I want to do a documentary, or at least a series, a documentary series on creativity. And I want to start with modular synthesis. So I just started making a list of names of people that had been into this for quite some time, the Alessandro Corsinis and the Richard Devines. But what I found really interesting were the people that were just up and coming, doing this because they absolutely loved to do it. The Julia Moores, the Synth Witch, Ty Resta, you know, Nick Turner, Sheila Tarudi, Zexy. I mean, just all these different artists that were up and coming and just posting things that they were doing. And what really inspired me was this was a community, a very supportive community, unlike any other musical community that I had experienced. And the joke was, if I were to go buy a guitar today and go online and say, hey, everybody be cool, I just bought this guitar, I'm going to show you me trying to play it, people would shut me down. I mean, it would be like, do yourself a favor, return it, you know, get your money back. But what I saw were people being so supportive and comforting. And, you know, I saw one guy bring home a system and he was like, I've never done this before, so I'm going to give it my first patch. And he just made this sound out of it that was like a whirring blender. But everybody that commented was like, do it, man. You've just begun the rest of your life. You've hit the journey. Just keep doing it. You'll get better. It was like so supportive that I just went, okay, what is this? It's not just the modular technology that's resurging. There's a connectivity and community and personality and character that is now becoming even more inspirational. So I basically mapped out this whole idea about the patch series, if you will, or the production. And I sat down, I said, here's what I want to do. And everybody in the room looked at me like, what? You want to do what? You want to do a technology documentary on modular synths? I'm like, no. See, there's a whole other thing brewing out there that is music, and it's gorgeous. And it's charged with passion and inspiration. And I want to capture that. It was totally selfish. I mean, to get down to the point, it was a selfish need of reconnecting with community, which I still feel that has been lost in music. And I wanted to sit in front of these people. So out of about 150 people that I found, I got into listening to the different artists. And as their music would emotionally connect with me, I'd put a check by them. And then I started to associate the different artists with like-minded artists. You know, for instance, you look at Todd Barton and Sarah Bell Reed, for instance. They're both classical trumpet players turned electronic composers. You look at Morten Subotnick and Bana Hafar, Mark Isham and Justin Melland, both cinematic composers using electronics as well. Nero and Julia Moore. You look at Peter Grenader, whose work, if you don't know who this guy, he's not on Instagram, he's not on Facebook, but his work is it's just genius. It really is. And then his, you know, counterpart being Shiro Fujioka in the same light. Then you got Corey and you've got Patrick O'Brien, Brian Knoll and Nick Turner, and then Basek and Daedalus. Now, Richard Devine is his own world of being. He's simply beyond comment or simply beyond comment or opinion. It's a living, breathing creature under his control. And the banter and conversation is in some cryptic language. It's so deep. I love it. I would never understand it. Just watching him and his love for it always came through. So I started to basically associate artists with their own character voice, because I realized, even beyond their knowledge, that this was an extension of who they were or who they really wanted to be through music, which is what music should be anyway. You should be able to, you know, derive some sense of somebody's personality and their character and their own human truth through their music. I don't find a lot of that anymore. I find a lot of creators, especially musicians, creating for a 60-second moment. And that's all they're thinking of is, I need something that's going to create incredible content and drive more likes and followers. In my world of listening to music and enjoying music, I don't care about any of that. I want somebody to do something from a place of honesty. I want to hear music that resonates with me, to where what's coming through my speakers, I believe that they believe in what they're doing. They have disconnected, they've put down their phone, they've turned off their screen, they've just gone someplace that is just true to themselves, and they don't care who likes it. They don't even know if they're going to like it, but they're enjoying it and it's doing something for them. And at the end of it, they go, here's my offering. That's it. Like it or not, this is me. And that's what I found a lot in the artists that I chose for Patch. As the more research I did, each one of them has just a brilliant story of why they chose to create in modular, you know. And that, again, was inspiring, where you have, you know, degreed musicians going, I put down my guitar, I put down my trumpet, and this is actually satisfying every part of my creative being just by patching. And then the ultimate thing of just turning it off and it being gone. That alone to me was far beyond any concept I had ever worked under. I mean, I'm a guy who currently on my phone, I have 500 plus little ideas, you know, in my memos. And I may never go back to them, or if there's something that I'm looking for, I'm like, oh, there's that idea that I had. But I'm always capturing, I'm always looking for that, you know, saving that inspiration, because at this point in my life, with family and business and children and a pandemic and learning to homeschool and all the above, it's just far and few between that I'm inspired on that level of purity. So to know that these artists create just for themselves in such a selfless manner and then turn it off, that alone, I wanted to find out why. How can you do that? Yeah. How can you just create something and just let it go? That's like a painter creating something and going, that's good, and then taking it out in the backyard and turning it into part of a campfire. You know, it's like, why would, don't you want to give it away to somebody? It's beautiful. No, that mindset was new to me. And I just wanted to know more about that. The real meaning behind Patch is about connectivity to honest creativity, of being present. When I got into the root of these artists and started doing more discovery and educating myself on their pasts, I realized that there was so much more to them than just their music. And that was what Patch was. It was just that connection to community, to presence, to creating freely. And I wanted to capture that. I wanted to bring that out and say, this is not just a bleeps and bloops and, you know, noise-making machine. This is somebody's voice. And they choose their modules to represent their voice. It becomes a character piece. You know, Banahafar blew my mind in the interview and totally broke me down as a musician when she says, I learned that I could decouple timbre from tonality. From notes and sound, I could decouple that. You've got your note, and then you've got the characteristic of that note, and you can separate them. I had never thought about that. If I'm playing a C on a synth, I'm thinking about modulation. I'm thinking about PWM. I'm thinking about oscillators. I'm thinking about the resonance. I'm getting into it. Now I'm affixed to what the character of that tone is going to be. But if you take out the note, then you're actually dealing with the characteristics that are emotionally charging that note. And once I started listening to her music, I was like, I get it. I get it. This is so visceral and so raw. It sounds like you've got a microphone inside a living being, and it's breathing, and it's growing, and it's connecting. And that, very much like Richard Devine, it blew my mind. It was really the sound of nature, the sound of humanity, the sound of existence beyond tonality. And again, that was just a completely new concept for me and changed everything that I knew about music. I've known 12 tones all my life and timbres, but this was something completely new for me and just opened up my world to a greater form of expression for myself and my own music. So to answer your first question...
David, you've done it so well.
38 minutes of epilogue. Patch is really about communication. It's not a technology-driven documentary, and so that's why this interview for me means so much, because you understand the technology, you understand creativity, and there's a responsibility to that. And so if there was something that I could tell people to focus on or learn from Patch or take out of Patch after they've watched it, it really is that sense of connectivity, not just the person to their modular system and that communication and that conversation, but it is their connectivity to the community, to where as a whole, they're all a part of this energy. That to me is the essence of what Patch the movie is. It's a creative arts film.
I think that really shines through right from the, it's not a historical documentary either, but looking at some of the roots of this and pulling it right up to modern day, it's the creativity that was around at that time that was the focus. It's not looking on a circuit level as to how that developed over the decades. It's what was this creativity that was happening? How has that worked through? Morten Subotnick's talking about it with Don Buchler's work. Herb Deutsch is talking about Bob Moog's work. And they're pulling through. And as you say, to then someone like Todd Barton that kind of parallels Sarah Bell Reed in some way, that just shines for me. And I think it makes it a documentary that I could sit and watch with my family that aren't interested in modular at all. They're respectful of it and what I do, but it's not their field of any interest in any way, but I think they would get something out of it. And I think that's the beauty of Patch CV, that it shows this, it's exciting. It shows this focus and this creativity, and that would rub off on anyone, I think. I don't play medieval lute, but if there was a similar documentary for Renaissance lute players that showed this creativity going on, I would absolutely be sucked into it and I'd want more of it instantly. We've said this before, Ed, a few times, that these kind of niche documentaries that pull into things,
yeah,
it's a really lovely thing to watch, and it documents what's been going on in a really nice way. It's a real good look at the modern modular scene in a very inviting, very inspiring way.
I think as well that it's a film that would inspire musicians or people maybe looking to or searching for an instrument
to take up, that is for sure. But there used to be an early 90s series that was called Passengers, and it was all about these little pockets of counterculture that you didn't know existed. Like, it was really early on in the cyberpunk scene that I watched Passengers. Whoa, God, this is really interesting. What this scene and what people are doing within this scene. And I think with Patch as well, even if people are not thinking of being inspired to get into the instrument, I think they'll find it very, very interesting as an almost underground counterculture thing that's sort of trickling through into the mainstream. Because that's how I see the modular world has. It's been sort of underground. It's been very counterculture-ish. And I think we're just at this big blossoming at the moment. It's coming into the mainstream. It's coming into hip-hop. It's filtering into lots of different genres of music now. And I think this is a perfect point to start documenting this. Because as I mentioned with Corey, I feel we're in a special place at the moment. This is a special community, very supportive, as you said. We're in a place where we've got some amazing creative artists. I've been drawn to it as a visual artist because I can see how I can reproduce my techniques in visual art within this almost machine that you can morph to your own way of working. And I think that it's important, and I thank you for this, it's important that this period is documented, because I think we will look back on it in 30 years' time and go, wow, that was an amazing period. I wonder what it was like to be an artist in that period. And you're covering that. And I think it's just essential. I mean, me and Ben used to talk about this, that we want more documentaries about niche things. And of course, we want more documentaries about modular esoteric instruments, you know, all that stuff. I gotta say, amazing camera work. Love the camera work's great, moody, shallow depth of field, you know, really, really nice. Gives a really nice cohesive feel to it. Production values, absolutely high and spot on. Editing was brilliant too. How did you come up with the storyline and piecing all this together? Because that in itself is a big creative task, because it had a flow, it had several strings going through it that all come together. That's quite a clever thing to do. I know when I'm in creative mode, it's a bit like a jigsaw and things come together that I didn't envision from the start. What was the creative process to get that and for it to end up so good?
All right. I'm glad you made that transition, because at some point I was going to go, I really have to give a lot of credit.
Yes.
You know, I can sit here and talk. Yeah, I can sit here, you know, and talk about the meaning behind it and my inspiration. But if I didn't have the creative partner that I did, this wouldn't exist on this level. Britt Thomas McTammany he's been a friend of mine for over a decade, mid-2000s, and we've made music together, and he's been in production for decades. He's been doing this all his life as well. I'd always been a fan of his visual works. As a photographer, he used to do so much for my record label, and we'd worked on different music videos together. And when it came time to do this, there's only one person that is going to understand this and get what I see as a vision. And when I sat down with Britt, I said, here's the idea. This is what I'm thinking. And he pulled up on his laptop, Swedish House Mafia. And it was this video that they had done where it just took all of this analog gear, and to the beat, they were just cutting the knobs and fiddling the knobs. And it just looked like the whole thing was animated. And he goes, you mean like this? And I went, exactly like that. Yeah. And I mean, he got it right on point from the onset. And so I said, here's my thoughts. And I basically outlined, as you can see in the movie, I said, I want to do a 6-part series. And it's going to be about design, inspire, community, compose. And that's when I started to associate the different artists and their backgrounds and their style of using the modular into these different categories. And so Britt and I would sit down after weeks on the road and come back with 15, 20 hours of video footage. And he would upload it for me, and I would go through there, and I'd parcel pieces out and say, okay, this is what I want to talk about here. I want them to say this. I want them to say this. And then I'd kind of put a storyline together. But because Britt innately knew where this was going and what it should be, he just took it upon himself and just started editing. And the most important thing about his editing, which it became very valuable knowledge to me as a creator, the editor creates the pulse of what you're watching. They create the flow. They create the energy. And as we would pick music, and I have to point out that the majority of the music that is used in the film was created on the spot by those artists in real time when we were filming them. We would do the interview first, and then we'd do 30, 40 minutes of them using their system and creating something for us. That was a big inspiration because we could start to set the flow with the music alone. Justin Melland would send us a piece of music that at one point in the film, there's just boom, boom, boom. It's like this heavy duty kick drum. And Britt had these shots of driving through LA with the palm trees, just like, just going in a row, right? And it just set up the whole episode from that moment.
Yeah, beautiful.
So it just helped having such great music and Britt's vision of this. It made it so easy. He worked his ass off on this. I can't say enough about his dedication to this project and his knowledge of editing to the music. That's a big part of this. And that to me is why it flows so well, is he understands that. He understands the rhythmic component, the melodic component to the dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's just years of him doing this. And I would just come back and go, okay, here are four more lines. We got to find out where that's going to come. And they go right here. We were both on the same page of what the dialogue and what the storyline should be.
Yeah.
We knew we had a certain time to get the message out. And it was just in that storyline. And we listened to this stuff and I decoded, you know, the narrative so many times and would just hand it over to him. And by the time I was done with that, he'd go, hey, look at this. And then he'd have 15 minutes of everything that I had just written down. He'd go, is this what you're talking about? I'm like, yeah, that is exactly it. We work seamlessly together just because he understands music and he understands communication. I mean, he spent his entire life making products for healthcare systems and corporate systems and short films and narratives. And so he gets it. He gets the flow. He gets that energy. And that's very rare and really came true to me when I'd watch somebody like Danny Elfman or Mark Isham or anybody say, you really got to have a relationship with the editor. Because he's the one who puts the whole film together. It's not anybody else. It's the editor. And working on this film with Britt really brought that home. And I went, I have so much respect for editors now. You know, he really set the tone and the value of this film. Yeah, again, hats off. He's like a brother to me. So he is a wealth of knowledge.
To stick with that point for a second, all those little bits of ramping in, as you say, the pulse, the editor is the pulse of the whole piece, but it's letting the audio just lead you in before the visual cue. And just to kind of ring back so people listening know what I mean, when this first came up in school for me, it was a case of moving from a scene at home to a scene in a school, and the school bell was ringing half a second before it cut to the school scene. So you were taken out of that living room into a school environment. And it's moving from moods and directing people. And it's just how long, because it's not a hard cut. It's not at 2 minutes 17, we go from this to this. It's what audibly fades across. It's a little bit like how much you start to open the hi-hat on a drum kit to let the energy lead you into a chorus. Do you start doing that four bars in? Do you do it in the last bar? Do you do it at all? Is it just about a bang and an impact happens? It's playing with the senses. And it does that so well. You don't know it's happening. I can't think of a scene where I knew that happened. I couldn't say, oh, when you went from LA back to Chicago, that 2 second pitch ramp that led you into that other bit of music. But I didn't notice them, but I know they're there. It just does it so well. And that, as you say, speaks to the team. You've got to have such a robust team. But it also speaks to the quality as what was shot, what was filmed, what was available, the music that was given on set, as you say, after those interviews. It's how that seemingly magically just comes together. The vibe of the people, the things that were captured, the mood, the atmosphere, what you were left to play with, and of course all the work then that goes into directing and managing that. It's just come together so incredibly well. It's lit so beautifully. And as someone that on a much more minor scale has been around to people's places when I've been off on trips and work, and I go, oh, we've got to sit down and do a quick interview. It's just a 10-minute YouTube thing. I'll have a camera in my bag and that's it, which obviously isn't a professional production. But what was put into that in terms of we're going to need this to go to their places and extract this from them? Was that just a case of the experience of the team and the crew? They knew what they need? Or were you trying to set a visual tone? How were you shooting for a storyline?
Again, this all came down to Britt and his years of working with incredible lighting directors and his sense of visual direction. And he also was able to implement many things that he'd always wanted to do, but wasn't given the license or the freedom to do because whatever the product might be, it might have been too artsy. You know, it might have been too cinematic, if you will. So we had two of these giant snow ski cases, and we would pack all of our lights in there and we would weigh them at 49.8 pounds. And then we had two Pelican cases that were two different Sony cameras, a couple of lenses, and then another one was two main LED panels and a bunch of these little auxiliary lights that he would put, like, depending on where we were, he would put like a little gel wrap around it, like a blue or a red gel wrap to give depth around the room. And I would talk to the artist when we got there. He'd go, where are we shooting? We'd walk in the room. And he would immediately look at the lights, look at the windows, look at what's going on, look at the space. And like that, he'd go, this is what I need. Okay, set up an LED over here, face it this way. I need an LED over there. And then he'd just run around the room, put up all these little LED auxiliary lights and set up his cameras. And I would be just talking to the person, you know, creating a sense of comfort in our dialogue and our communication. And the whole time he's adjusting lights and he's adjusting his cameras. And by the time it was ready, he just knew how to make it look great. Now, with that in mind, he would go back and he would colorize every part of an interview. That was the art. The art that he created that you see in Patch is his ability to color correct and make everything visually connect. And that was a whole other thing that I didn't understand either, was color grading. And once he started doing this, I went, oh, so that's how it looks like a movie and not somebody's bedroom. The whole process was it was a learning process for me just to understand how to make a movie. You know, I'm a music guy. I've dabbled in video myself, but not on that level. And so just learning what it takes to make a movie and make something visually, you know, presentable on that level, just it's painstakingly admirable for somebody to have that kind of tenacity to just keep going for it. He's great at what he does. Yeah.
I think as we talked earlier about what were the strands of your past, he's one of those strands, isn't he? You're lucky to have crossed paths all those years ago, become friends. Oh, yeah. To get your expression out, because it just sounds like you gel as one. And that's probably one of the reasons why this looks so good. It flows so well and everything about it is just right.
Right on. Thank you so much. I mean, that appreciate you guys recognizing that and seeing the value in that. It was a long time editing. You know, 45-minute interview was hours of editing. Hours. Yeah. At the end of the day, I think we had 70, 80 hours of visuals to cut through.
That's huge.
Yes.
It started out as a series. I think I bought the first three. Did you do three before you switched it over mm-hmm. to a film? So I got the first That's three. And then it was announced that it's coming out as a film. And I thought, oh, right. fantastic. What was the decision from going from a series to a film? And how did that sort of morph over its entire lifetime of being created?
Well, it has a twisted answer. So going back to how I opened up this interview of being honest and be creative and following your voice and finding your sense of value within something that you create, and then having externals say, if you did this, you'd have more success. If you did that, you'd have more success. You should do this because there's more success in that. And this is actually a pathway to more success. And then you go, okay, so we can have success with this if we do XXXXX.
Yeah.
So the idea was a series
yeah.
because we wanted it to be bite-sized with Netflix and Hulu and HBO. Everybody was coming up with series.
Yeah.
And a series could be 4 episodes, could be 5 episodes, could be 13 episodes. Actually, when we first started, it was 14 episodes, but we cut it down to 6. Just because of time and finances. We don't even talk about finances at this point because...
Yeah. I don't want to even think about the costs of it, to be fair, but...
Yeah. So when we started, you know, putting out the series, we just felt as much information that was there, for me, it was missing the connectivity. It was missing the flow. I just felt like every time I'd watch an episode, I was kind of left dangling and hanging there. It's like in this purgatory type of place. Going, I want more, but is it done? Is there more? You know, there should be more. I want more about that.
Yeah.
So then we started talking to different distribution companies at the time. And they would say, well, if you made a film, it's a lot easier to place a full-length feature documentary than it is a series. That was one person. Then we'd talk to somebody else and they'd say, you know, it's a lot easier to place a series nowadays. People want series as it is to a full-length documentary. So it was a challenge. I mean, when you have externals saying that you need to change something for their benefit, just total disregard for your value and your vision of it, that's when we decided, you know what? I don't know how this is going to happen or how we're going to do it, but we are self-distributing this, and this is how we're going to do it, and it's going to be a pain in the ass, and this is going to be a learning curve, but we're doing it. I don't care what anybody else has to say. I'm not editing this. I'm not inserting anything. I'm not doing anything to make anybody see a value for themselves in this. That's really how the film went from being a series to being a film, was we just wanted it to flow. We wanted it to be a complete thought. That's how it became a full-length feature film.
As complete as it feels, I want more.
Oh, come on.
There is. So I joke that, you know, we're going to have Patch CV2, Electric Boogaloo. You know, it's going to be a whole other series. We actually thought about if this has any potential success to actually do a UK version of it. We'd actually thought about, let's go back now, let's cross the pond and go over there and gain inspiration from there. At one point, we were going to go to Japan. So it all just came down to finances and time. But we have ideas of creating some kind of portal that will give you the whole 45-minute, hour-and-a-half conversation interview with each of these artists. I mean, some of the stuff that we couldn't pack in is just brilliant, absolutely brilliant knowledge. And just getting more in depth into their background and their sense of value and their life and their creative energy. There's so much of that that's not in the film. At some point, I'm like, well, we should just take all these 52 interviews and put them up on a site and let people really connect with the artist at that point and let them see them do the music in real time that they provided for the film. So you're seeing an hour and 38 minutes of 100 hours of captured thoughts and knowledge and beauty. Yeah, there's enough to make 3 more movies, you know?
one of my things is, let's hope this is a success, because I'd love to see money come in from that so you can make more. Right. And we really hope that it is going to be successful, because I really, really want more. I think that, you know, having all those interviews in some sort of portal that we can pay for and yet fund another film somehow like that, as well as obviously purchasing films so that all you guys may be tempted to do another one. I think that's a great idea. It's so fast moving that you could do one of these films annually with all the new people that are coming through, with how the scene's morphing, and it would be as interesting as the years before. And we've got some years to go, I think, before we're going to really see the peak of all the right. creativity with this. And it would be just lovely, again, if you could document that in films, sure. you know, going along the path of the evolution of this. So I really hope that the money return on this is enough for you to be able to go, right, let's do this again. How are you looking to try and do that? Is it just let's hope for the best, get it out there everywhere? What's it being released on at the moment? Where can we buy it? I know we're last talking to you. You said Amazon might be releasing it at some stage. We can have a date for
by the way, I was just going to say, I meant to mention this, it's released on Amazon.
Wow, great.
It happened yesterday.
Oh, wow. I was like, good timing.
Ah! You know, man, I screamed like a little girl. I mean, it was like my wife came down. What's wrong? Are you okay? I'm like, it's published. Woo! I was jumping up and down. And I sat there on the couch and I started posting that it was and sending pictures of the screenshots to my friends. And she walks over to me. She goes, are you excited about it? And I reached up and I just like wiped a tear from my eyes. She goes, are you crying? I went, maybe just a little. It's like, you know what this journey has been to get it to this point, to get it to the people. Yeah, it was been a learning experience and curve and everything that goes along with it. As much as we'd like to see a return on this, the value for us, yes, it would be great to see something come back and actually repurpose funding for something else, like another film or another project related to this. But what I'm hoping is this is an introduction to the community to go and discover these artists. Because what's funny is when we started this, a lot of these artists were just kind of up and coming. They had 500 followers, 1,000 followers, you know, and now they're into tens of thousands of followers. And when we first started looking at hashtags and what would like help promote what we were doing, there is now triple the followers of those hashtags like modular synth and electronic music, triple the amount of followers that there were then, now, currently. So our audience reach has just completely expanded. And I would love to see all the artists that have Patreons, like Brian Knoll and Shiro and Corey. I would love the community to go out and search for them and support them so that they can do their art. But that would be the gift. I mean, if there was something to come out of all of this, I'd love to see those artists prosper and extend their opportunities for success through this film. That would be the reward for me, yeah. You know, because I've been on both sides of success. I've been on the side where I'd get up 3 o'clock in the morning and look out my third story window down onto the street because I heard a noise, thinking they're towing my car because I couldn't pay for it. And then there's other times where I'm looking out at my car because I enjoy the new car that I bought. Yeah. You know, so I would love to see these people reap the rewards of this film because they deserve it. They really deserve it. Yeah. I mean, as much as we'd love to make another one, if that doesn't come about, you know, like you said, I hope that in 30 years, somebody goes, there was this film and it captured this moment in time. Yeah. You know, and I'm like, yeah, that would be pretty amazing. You know, again, I appreciate this time and your appreciation for the film and your support of the film. It means the world to me because I respect you both and what you do and your knowledge and sense of creativity. Yeah, for me, this has been a great moment and a great way to help promote this and connect with the community. But again, we hope to do something in the future and we hope to create some kind of portal. But more importantly, I would love to see these artists become successful through this or be able to take advantage of these, you know, opportunities from this.
So. Yeah, well, thank you for your kind words. And we want to see this whole community blossom. And again, with us, I sort of want that to happen to you. So we can have more great content too. So just to reiterate, where can we get it at the moment then?
Right now you can get it on Vimeo because that seems to be the global portal. You can get that in any country currently. Right now it's on Amazon. It got published for the UK and the US, and we're working on the Japanese release and the German release.
Right.
So we're hoping in the next couple of months on Amazon it will be global. And at the same time, we're going for iTunes. Hopefully it'll get picked up by Netflix as another opportunity for viewers, another portal. But Amazon was a really big step for us because everybody knows it. Everybody has access to it. That was a big moment for us to actually have that type of portal to get the film out.
It's just an easy buy on Prime, isn't it? Because I've got Prime. And if that That's popped it. Up on Prime, I'm like, yeah. I mean, right. that, boom, pay, gone. Amazon's a bane of my life. It just makes my money vanish in lots of directions. Right. But yeah, it's a great platform to sort of get on, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Because of Patch, I'm starting a new series myself that is going to discuss basically the intangibles of creativity, talking about people's passions and how they create their identity and why they do what they do, free from technology. It's going to be about why they do what they do. Yeah. Not just music. It's going to be arts of all kinds. It's going to be business. So it's going to be about why people do what they do and why they love it and how they connect with that.
Is that a podcast form that you'll be doing that in?
It's going to be video and wow, and brilliant. Podcast. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, both.
Great.
I don't know if it'll have the same visual value.
Has any of that lovely creative tonal lighting rubbed off on you?
Actually, it has. Yeah. And I learned a lot from that. But as far as, you know, the in-depth color grading goes and all the cinematic value, it's not going to be that at all. So
when's the show coming out, David? Have you started yet?
I'm starting filming August this month. I've got a couple interviews lined up. It's harder because we are completely failing as a country with the pandemic.
Yeah.
And the people that I would want to have in the studio, they're not available, or you just can't get that one-on-one. So that's why it's probably going to start as a podcast and eventually turn into more of a visual component. But in the meantime, I'll still be doing my visual part of it, just sitting on camera talking about creativity and talking about, again, the intangibles and all the lessons that I've learned that were given to me freely by incredible people, people that are at the top of their game, at the top of their art. Which is really what I want to do at this point in my life, is just take all that value and not die with it. And so that's what I'm hoping to create in this new endeavor. But I'll let you know about that.
I suppose, Ben, we sort of better wrap it up here, aren't we? Because we could.
You've got a lot of editing to do.
Yeah, we could talk all day, to be fair. It's been absolutely fantastic having you on. Just quickly, before we wrap it up, I know there's a vinyl series that accompanies this as well. Where can we purchase those as well?
You can get the vinyl series, which is a 3-album, 3-vinyl series, on patchcv.com. There's a store. We will be running from time to time specials. It's a great collection of music. Again, because I come from a background of making records and I was in the art of side A and side B, it was really fun for me to use that knowledge in creating this series to where there is flow and there is energy. And again, Britt did an amazing job on the covers and the artwork. So for us, it's just another piece of art to give to the community.
Fantastic.
Really look forward to the new podcast and video shows. There's no limit to where inspiration comes from or where creativity will take us and how other people's creativity will influence us. So I really like those kind of mixed medium, wide range of people. It's fantastic. And thinking of having you on again, we've skipped past the fact that you played drums with Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
All this great intro and information that was on there. It's almost forgotten at this point. Yeah. It's like, hang on a minute. Well,
and I'm just going to touch on that really quick. It was one of those moments where I went, this guy's real. You know, you watch somebody like that and you're like, he's an entertainer. But then you work with him and you're like, no, this this guy believes everything. Again, it's a part of Hatch. It's about the community. It's about the connection. It's about the truth in being a creative individual, much like yourselves, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. At the end of the show, we like to give some shout outs, and I'd like to shout out a couple of other podcasts to start with. Kyle and Robert's Source of Uncertainty. I'm naming that Soup from now on. It's a good soup.
Good idea. Never thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah. The Source of Uncertainty Soup, yes. The Buchla podcast. That lure of Buchla is always on my mind. And yeah. It's again, thinking of the show we've just done, it's those creative individuals around that. I think Buchla, I think Todd Barton, and then my mind is just wandering down this kind of artistic path. We've got Tim Held, PodMod, also Waveform Magazine, which has moved to its new paid subscription model and seems to just be going from strength to strength. Fantastic bit of work from Ellison and the team. The good people of Patchworks in Seattle. And I've also got a streaming resource at bit.ly/coronastreams. And we'll put links in the show notes for all of this. You can, of course, contact us as well. If there's anything we've mentioned in the show that you didn't quite catch a link or a name, we'll certainly be happy to guide you to the right place.
We release our show every month, so remember to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform. And if you find yourself over there and you've enjoyed the show, then please leave a thumbs up and a review. If you'd like to listen to more in-depth show notes, then head over to our website at www.esotericmodulation.com.
And finally, look us up on Instagram and Facebook, where you can pop us those questions, whether it's about this particular episode, general questions, things you may have missed. But I think that about rounds us up. I want to just keep talking for hours.
No, David, it's been fantastic, but not enough time.
Right. I understand. I've been told on several occasions that you didn't allow us to ask you much. You just talk. I want to talk so much about why I love electronic music and my synthesizer background and, you know, everything from Heaven 17, Cabaret Voltaire, and Scritti Politti.
Oh, man.
I want to talk about, you know, I want to talk about it all. Yeah.
Well, it'd be great to have you back on in, you know, maybe 6 months' time when we can see how, say, Patch CV's gone and the trajectory of that. So it'd be great to definitely have you on again.
I'd love it. Thank you guys so much. It's very meaningful. Very grateful.
Thank you very much. Well, Ben, I'll see you next month.
Yeah, cheers for coming on again, David. And yeah, see you next time.
See you. Bye all.